you know, if I can't control my anxiety, then I'm going to try to control my external environment.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like, garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think, ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
Her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest today is Scott Gornto, a licensed marriage and family therapist, certified sex therapist, and expert on relationships and personal development. Scott works with individuals, couples, families, groups, and businesses. He is the author of The Stories We Tell Ourselves and a frequent Huffington Post contributor. Here's the interview.
Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Great. Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
I'm happy to have you on. Your book is called The Stories We Tell Ourselves. Stop jumping to conclusions, free yourself from anxiety, transform your relationships. And I'm really happy to have you because that's one of the things we talk about on this show a lot is the fact that we're always telling ourselves stories and that we have some degree of choice. So when I saw the title of your book, I was like, well, we got to have this guy on as a guest, a whole book about this topic. So
that's great. Yeah. I'm
happy to have you. Let's start off with the parable. Our show is called The One You Feed, and it's based on the parable of two wolves where there's a grandfather who's talking with his grandson. And he says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love. And the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandson stops and he thinks about it for a second and he looks up at his grandfather and he says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in the work that you do.
That's great. I love that parable. You know, the first thing that comes to mind is the term duality, that we all have this internal duality inside of us around a number of things, whether it's, you know, I love my job, and then there's another part of me that's frustrated with my job, right? Or I love my wife or my husband, and there's another part of me that can't stand them, right? There's that internal duality that we face as human beings constantly. And I think in terms of the parable specifically, another piece that speaks to me around it is when I think about, you know, I do a lot of work with folks dealing with trauma, early childhood trauma of some kind, whether it be abuse or, you know, some type of bullying or physical or emotional or sexual type abuse growing up or an event that took place and then going into adulthood and doing behavior that is addictive in nature, whether it's food or sexuality or drugs or alcohol or a number of different escapism, numbing behaviors. So these behaviors end up, you know, coming out in a variety of ways. And you know, I think that's, you know, if we talk about that world, when we're talking about addiction, you know, in particular, whether you feed the addict or whether you feed the healthy part of you depends on what's going to grow and take over. And so that's, so it kind of hits me on a couple different levels. One is the internal duality that we all face, this two parts of us that wrestle with decisions in life. And when those decisions become more complex and the love and the hate are mixed together about 50% each, then the anxiety and the depression could kick in, right? But then on the addiction side, when we, you know, that part of us that we feed different parts of us that are either unhealthy or healthy. So we have some choice in that. So It's a fantastic parable and concept, and you guys sound like you've got a great thing going there, so it's good.
Well, thank you. So your book is called The Stories We Tell Ourselves. Will you, for the listeners, describe what you mean when you say that?
Yeah, you know, I think that our perception or the way that we view the world has a lot to do with our behavior. I think I like to think of, a belief system is a group or a set of opinions we develop loyalty to over time. So if, you know, I believe or I create an opinion that my wife means X when, you know, by what she just said, or my boss gives me a look and I interpret that through my own lenses, my own perception, or if my friend doesn't text me back, you know, and it's been a day since I've texted, or going on and on and on, right? 16-year-old daughter doesn't text when she's on her date with her boyfriend and she's past her curfew. And, you know, so we tell ourselves narratives. So there's these internal narratives that we play out. And I think that we have a tendency many times to tell ourselves more negative stories that end up not being true. In fact, most of us as human beings, and some people do it stronger than others and more intensity, but most of us as human beings, you know, we end up doing this quite a bit. And I would say a good 95% of the stories, maybe higher, don't ever come true. But we would tell ourselves these sort of anxious or anxiety-ridden stories. And so that's a bit about, you know, the narrative, the story within the book. But that's what I mean when I talk about the stories we tell ourselves, these negative anxiety-ridden stories that we make up and create.
Yeah, I think one of the teachings that I learned that I think fundamentally changed me more than any other was the Buddhist nun Pema Chodron talks about drop the storyline and feel the emotion. And your book talks an awful lot about that, about getting more into your body, out of your brain.
Yes.
But one of the things that you said is that when we're writing the stories in our head, we are the screenwriter, the director, and the star of our own movie.
Yes, yes. You know, if I create an internal narrative about a text I sent over to a friend and they've not responded, you know, I'm the star because it's about me. I'm not considering that they have another life, they have their own life, and maybe there's something else going on, right? They've got their family or they've got something else going there. They forgot, right? But I'm the star. And then I'm producing it and directing it because I'm walking through the path in my brain of what's going on and making up a narrative. And like I said, most of the time, it's not true. So, I love what you said earlier about dropping the storyline and feel the emotion. That's exactly what I'm trying to get at, is that I'm a real big believer on trying to pay attention to your internal experience. But when you get into your head, and I'm not talking about the anxious narrative of your brain, I'm talking about getting into your body a bit more. And so, you know, when we tell ourselves these negative anxiety-ridden stories, one of the things that we have to do is catch ourselves doing it. And the other thing is that we catch ourselves by noticing what we feel in our body. Mm-hmm. The better we become aware of that, the more we can pull our brain back into our body and not let it float away somewhere and take us into fantasy land. And the fantasy is the movie, the script that we create over here, rather than living in real life with what we know to be true, what we knew to be false, and actually having a conversation with the person.
Yeah, and it's remarkable to me how much those stories, what they are, the content of them, really affects how we feel about a situation and how if we get different information,
yes,
we can feel dramatically different. In the, I don't know if you ever read The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It's a book
yes.
I love. But
yeah.
He tells a story, you know, Covey tells a story of being on a train with a couple kids who are running all around on the subway, just creating havoc, yelling, screaming, driving everybody crazy. And he's getting more and more irritated. And he finally turns to the father and he says, "Sir, you know, could you deal with your children? You know, everybody on the car is really upset." And the guy looks up at him and says, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, we just came from the hospital. We just lost their mother." And in that instant,
yeah,
everything changed for him.
That's right. That's right.
You know, his whole, everything he thought about that man, all the stories that he was telling himself changed. And I think that's a lot of what you're stressing, is if we can get away from whatever story we're making up and try and find out the reality.
That's exactly it. I also think that there is something to be said about us telling ourselves more positive stories.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I'm driving down the road and I cut somebody off on accident, on the freeway and they pull up next to me and they decide to flip me off because they're angry, right? I can tell myself a story that I'm the bad guy. I could tell myself a story that that guy's had a bad day. I could tell myself a lot of stories, but a positive story I might tell myself is, hey, you know what? Who knows what's going on in that guy's life?
Right.
You know, he might be struggling. You know, who knows what situation he's in? And so if I'm able to live with a little bit of empathy and compassion rather than anger and revenge, you know, talking about the duality there and that, those two parts of us, then perhaps I'm able to give that guy the benefit of the doubt. And many times, you know, in relationships, if we've been burned or if we've lost trust or if we've been wounded in our past or there's been a traumatic situation or there's a lot of things that influence us, certainly, but that we have a tendency to go more towards the negative. And, you know, I wish it wasn't the case, but I think it is for most people. And like I said, some people do this more than others in terms of the intensity, you know, in terms of the negative narrative. So.
Yeah, if you recognize that you're making it up, then you can choose to try and make it, you know, make it a little bit more positive. You say that much of the pain in relationships can be traced back to the stories that we tell ourselves. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that you know, think about, you know, I do a lot of work with couples in my practice as a therapist and you know, practitioner, you know, working with folks dealing with a range of issues. And certainly, you know, these narratives that we play out are in the context of relationships. I mean, you know, if they aren't in isolation, they aren't in a vacuum, they're in the context of relationships. You know, each one of those the stories that I shared earlier, the examples, the teenage daughter that's on a date, the boss who gives a certain look, you know, or the boss who sends an email at, you know, 3:30 on a Friday afternoon and says, we got to talk Monday morning, first thing, important news, you know, and the narrative you play yourself in your brain all weekend, right? These are stories that we play out from a not knowing when we don't have all the information, we tell ourselves stories, but we could even play that in terms of friendship or a dating or committed partnership. You know, I think about with my own marriage, I'm married and, you know, my wife will say something and I'll commit to a certain opinion about what she meant by that. I'll jump to conclusions, react, you know, get angry. So I've done, you know, all sorts of steps. I've digested what she said. I've developed some loyalty to a certain opinion. I've created a belief around that. I've solidified that belief. And then I've reacted all in about 1 second. Right.
Yep.
And so if you break that down and you begin to think about, you know, how is this? You know, what's the context here? It's in the context of relationships. So much of the pain that we struggle with internally has to do, and this anxiety has to do with that it's really in the context of relationships because as human beings, we're relational people. We are meant to be in some level of community, whether that's in a small group, a partnership, a friendship, a family, a community, you know, something, you know, a business. That we're relational creatures. So that's what I mean by the pain is that we end up jumping to conclusions and living more in our head sometimes than we do actually engaging with the person and having a conversation.
And here's the rest of the interview.
You say that anxiety and ignorance are vacuums and our imagination rushes in to fill the space. So I think what you're saying is that...
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
As people, we have a desire to understand what's happening, what something means, and if we don't know, we're gonna fill it in. And you also say that assumptions wreak havoc in our relationships. So, what are some things that we can do in those moments where we get something that sends us off into creating the stories? Maybe we don't have, maybe two situations. One would be we can't go find out the truth right away. So what are some things, like the example you gave? Okay, my boss sends me an email 3:30 on Friday, says we got to talk Monday morning, and I can't get an answer till Monday morning. What can I do with myself? You know, how can I work with those stories over that long weekend?
Well, you could first run for the hills, right? you don't know, there's all sorts of options people do, right? They turn to alcohol, right? Or some escapism or numbing. Some people make choices to turn to a friend to talk about it. Other people bottle it up and go inward and internalize it and try to, not think about it. Right, there's all sorts of reactions, sort of a fight or flight reaction. From a healthy standpoint, what I talk about in the book is that, I think a first step is trying to get a little more information. Send an email back and saying, hey, give me a heads up on what we're going to be talking about. I'd like to have a little more information. And let's say the boss sends some more information. You got a little more information. If he or she doesn't send more information, then you've got to sit with the not knowing. And I think there is something to be said about sitting with the not knowing. It's hard to do. Most of us want to control. And we want to control because we want to feel safe. And when we don't feel safe, we look to a lot of things to try to calm us. And so I think healthy ways of doing that is learning. I walk through a 7-step process on how to manage anxiety, a very simple way of managing different aspects of anxiety. It's certainly not comprehensive to all anxiety that's out there, but some of the circumstantial anxiety we're talking about, it can be helpful. And part of that process is learning to define literally writing down, what is it that I can control in this situation? What is it that I can't? With the situation with the boss, I can't control if he or she hasn't given me more information. I can't control getting more information. It's out of my hands. So if I'm learning to say, I've got to learn to surrender to what I can't control. Now, that's easier said than done.
It sure is.
At the same time, it's part of what it means to be human. I mean, I was on a flight recently and the turbulence was just terrible. I mean, I've been on a lot of flights over the years and it was the worst turbulence I've ever been on and been in rather. And it lasted for an hour and we were 35,000 feet. And so I kept reminding myself that, no flights or very few flights have ever come down out of the sky from 35,000 feet. Everybody in the flight attendants flying up and down, hitting the ceiling, hitting the floor. People are yelling, of course I've got a 12-year-old sitting next to me on his iPad, smiling, watching a movie the whole time. It doesn't help things when I'm making myself anxious over here. Right. He's all calm. But I literally said to myself, with all the anxiety I was feeling, I said to myself, I'm making up stories. I have no idea. But you know what? I can't control this. I'm up in the air. I have no power over what happens next. And I made a decision to, over about 20 minutes, to work on literally thinking in my brain, I've got to surrender to this. If this is what I'm going, then this is it. And I can't make myself hold on. Now, that's fighting against every part of me as a human that wants to fight for life. At the same time, I had to come to a place of surrender, and spirituality is important to me. So I leaned into that a bit. And I got to be honest, I was able to get to that place after probably 15, 20 minutes. And then that, and I was able to calm myself for that, that next 10 or so minutes, 15 minutes of turbulence. And I was, and then it stopped, but you know, the turbulence stopped. And so, you know, I think that that's just one small way. I mean, I think it's something that we have to work at, is learning how to surrender. And some of us want to hold on to life really, really tight, me included. And, you know, that's something I'm continuing to learn to put into practice, even what I put down on paper and what I've seen with clients over the years.
Yeah, the less tight your hold on life, often the better it is. And I think a lot of that, what you described there, and you talk, you spend a lot of the later part of the book talking about this, is the awareness of that what's even happening. So, okay, yes. Now I'm telling myself a story, and the story I'm telling myself is that this plane yes. is going to go down.
Exactly.
And then once you have that awareness, then you can work with trying to soothe yourself or find other things.
You got it.
You've got sort of an awareness spectrum, and you spend a lot of time talking about that. Can you go a little deeper into some of your thoughts on awareness?
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing that up a moment ago too, about awareness. Yeah, sometimes I forget about that piece. That's certainly a step one in the process, is just the recognition. It gives you a little power when you can name it and have an understanding of it. It's kind of like, you know, I remember a buddy of mine in graduate school, he had a brother that spent 3-4 years trying to find a diagnosis for some physical symptoms he was having that were so painful for him. And they went from doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor, and finally found a diagnosis, and the freedom in just knowing what it is, you know. So I think there's a level of the no, having an awareness of what you're feeling that gives you a little bit of power in that dynamic. So in terms of just awareness in general, and my own journey, you know, as a therapist, and just as a person, you know, I like to have an understanding of things, and not just trying to control things or manipulate, not that, more of an understanding of a level of awareness. So I try to start with my body and my emotions and what's going on inside of me. And I find that to be one of the most important pieces to being grounded in conversation, whether I'm talking with my wife or my kids, that I've got to get grounded first and notice what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking, so I'm not just reacting. And I think awareness is power, because it gives me the option to be proactive. So those are a few things to come to mind. But yes, a lot of my work with clients, and certainly a lot of the language in the book, is about awareness. And I think it's, you know, there's certainly a lot of Eastern thought in awareness and paying attention to your body and your breathing and yourself. And over the last, you know, let's say 20 plus years in the States, we've gotten a little more of a, I think that is begin to weave its way in a healthy way into a lot of different fields, whether it's in medicine or psychotherapy, or certainly yoga, or an exercise. So it's sort of weaved its way in a number of different fields more than probably it ever has.
Yeah. You describe kind of one of the results of doing this type of work is becoming a person of presence. And you talk about what a lot of those benefits are. What are some of the benefits of, you know, doing this thing where we work on our awareness and we train ourselves and we become more of, like you say, a person of presence?
What comes to mind, number one, is peace. When I'm functioning in those attributes, and I'm noticing a sense of peace in my own life, and I think other people recognize that there's a sense of centeredness or groundedness in me. And I think other people, when I recognize that in someone else, when they're living out qualities like humility and having good boundaries in their life with others, and they're able to have a sense of self-confidence, and, you know, they're able to have those different, you know, there's six different sort of ingredients or points that I make there, and those are three that I've named, there's really a level of peace. And I think, you know, isn't that what a lot of people would like to have in their life, is more peace? And I don't mean a peace like, you know, just a momentary peace, but a sense of contentment or groundedness that, you know, different philosophies and religions sort of speak to it. I know in Judaism, you know, the word is shalom. It's, you know, this essence of being, having a full sense of peace or an embodiment of calmness. So it's more than just one word. It's sort of an embodiment. So that's what comes to mind. I mean, I think there are other things as well, but that's really what I'll highlight.
What are some practical steps that we can take to increase our awareness? You know, if we would think of it as a muscle, you know, our awareness muscle, how do we practice that? How do we strengthen that?
I think first and foremost, it's starting with your body and your breathing. You know, everybody can pay attention to their breathing. Everybody can pay attention to noticing what their body's doing, where I'm feeling tension. What part of my body am I feeling it in? How big is it? Right? I remember asking a client today, she was feeling a lot of anger, tremendous amount of anger at her parent. And this is, you know, a woman in her 60s and her mom's still living and she has a lot of anger towards her. And she said I said, where do you notice it? You know, she said, I'm right in the middle of my chest. I said, how big is it? You know, it's about the size of my fist. What color is it? Just really getting clarity about, you know, what is the anger saying? So it's really kind of narrowing in on what you physiologically feel, because your body teaches us things. And it's not just, let me try to think more about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an awareness of body. So that's one. I think also what can increase awareness is by practicing learning how to be more present, which I focus on two key elements. One is breathing, taking deep breaths. And the second is letting your senses come alive. So as I'm sitting in this room talking with you, I can look around the room and I could see a painting across the room, right? And I can notice the colors and the texture. I can feel the chair that I'm sitting in, right? Or I could smell the air that's around me, a candle burning, you know? So allowing myself to be in the moment can increase awareness because I'm paying attention to my senses. So those are a couple of things. And certainly I talk more about this in the book, but those are a couple of things that come to mind. And I'll say one other thing. If you're talking with someone else in your relationship, you pay attention to what you're noticing. You know, what do you notice in their hand expressions, their facial expressions, their words, their body posture? You know, just paying attention and let that be something that speaks to you. And so I think awareness can come in a lot of shapes and sizes, but that's just initially what comes to mind.
One of the things I like that you do in the book that I think is important to stress is that we're not very good at this when we start. But that we can definitely get better at it by continuing to do it. And I think there's a real tendency. I think I was this way for a while when I would try and, you know.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Be in the present moment, and I would find that that was really hard, and I would do it for a second, or I would, you know, yep. Think I just can't do this, and the tendency is to give up. Whereas if you keep working on it, my experience has been you move closer, and you talk about that. That's a continuum of becoming, you know, becoming a person's of presence. Kind of is at the far end of having spent a lot of time and energy to get there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. The awareness continuum increases, and so you're able to catch yourself while you're doing it, or in the very act to be at choice with behavior. Yes, I'm aware that there. You know, that's the great thing about this is it's not just okay. There's some people who are born with this, and some people aren't. And you know, oh well, you know, so sorry for you. You know, you weren't born with this. No, this is something you can develop. Some people do have a more natural ability of this because their intuition or their family they're raised in, or the training that they've done. But we certainly can all grow in this. And it is, if you don't know how to do it at first, it is something that you can learn over time. And I do think there's a level of awareness that comes with getting older. You know, mm-hmm. I think there is a level of, you know, experience and history that teaches us things that there's awareness there. But yeah, it's a skill that can be developed.
You had a line in the book that really struck me, and it says, "People who can't control themselves try to control other people." Can you expound on that?
You know, if I can't control my anxiety, then I'm going to try to control my external environment so I can feel less anxious. And anxiety, in my mind, is one of the most significant aspects or ingredients that are in committed relationships. People feel anxious because the person's pulling away. People get anxious because they're in conflict. People get anxious because they've got to talk with their partner about something that's difficult. This level of anxiety is you know, and I'm using anxiety in a broad sense, not mm-hmm. just people who get nervous about something, but I'm using it in a broader sense. So yeah, when as human beings, when we can't control ourselves, meaning we don't know how to self-soothe or manage our own emotions, then we're going to try to control our environment. That's our next best thing. And usually it's the people around us. So, you know, you could think about that. You know, I'm sure if you spent some time thinking about that in your own family, right, you could probably come up with scenarios that stand out to you. I know I could for me, you know, in my family and in my own life that I've done. You know, clients, I could think of stories over and over again. I was listening to a story today, right? An adult in his 40s, you know, mom staying with him in her 60s or 70s. And she was, you know, she gets anxious because, you know, he doesn't do what she wants when she comes to visit. And so she tries to control him. Well, what does he do? He gets anxious about her trying to control him. And so he tries to control her, right? This is what they do. And they drive each other crazy and they don't want to spend time together, right? Yep. No one wants to be controlled. And so people typically pull back in those kind of relationships. So, you know, learning how to balance emotion in yourself is it's an important factor in terms of friendships and professional relationships and committed partnerships, because, you know, that will become problematic. And, you know, like I said, people don't like it. So
one last question. We're kind of at the end of time.
Yeah,
or observation. But you had another line that really struck me. And this one really struck me as like really pertinent to me in certain cases. And it said, "When we fail to share our deeper experiences about life's events, we're actually providing ripe material for the other person to create stories about us."
Yeah. You know, one of the most significant areas that I do work with clients is helping them learn how to talk about their heart and their mind, because that breeds intimacy. You've got to have a level of awareness first, though, right? I've got to know what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling and be able to share that with you. Now, people who do that well and are proficient at that, you get to know them. Mm-hmm. People who don't do that, you don't get to know them, and they're harder to know, or they're harder to know rather. And as a result, the person on the other side of that makes up more stories because they're not given material. Mm-hmm. You know, there's plenty of couples in relationship who don't know one another. They may know things about each other, but they don't know their day-to-day personal experience. Like, hey, I'm struggling with this, or I'm happy about this, or this is was difficult for me, or that really hurt when you said that, or I'm really angry at you about that decision you've made, you know, and this is what's going on for me, or I heard this song and it stirred up this emotion or this experience for me. I wanted to share it with you, right? Those are letting people in. And when you do that, most people are able to say, oh gosh, wow. Okay. That's pretty vulnerable, number one. But number two, I feel like I know you. You know, so that's what I mean by that. If we're not showing up and letting the real authentic us show up, then it becomes problematic on terms of people knowing us.
Yep. Well, I definitely think I have probably produced a bunch of stories in people's heads based on that sentence, thinking back over some of my past. So that was really, really helpful for me to read. So I think that brings us to the end, but thanks so much, Scott. I really enjoyed...
You bet. You bet.
Enjoyed talking with you. I enjoyed the book.
Great.
We'll have links to all your stuff on our show notes at oneufeed.net. And thanks again.
You bet. Really enjoyed it. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Okay. Bye. Bye.
You can learn more about Scott Gorto and this podcast at oneufeed.net/Scott.